News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Consensus on anything seems in short supply these days, given our nation's political divides. But many researchers and politicians from across the spectrum have recently agreed on this. The idea that anyone can make it in America isn't what it used to be. Academics call it economic mobility, and in this country, it's practically gospel. Generations have been told that if you work hard and play by the rules, you can move up the success ladder. But new studies cast doubt on whether this cherished ideal is true. One by the Pew Charitable Trusts finds that 65% of Americans born at the economic bottom stay there. And several international studies have all concluded that the U.S. now ranks lower in terms of income mobility than most industrialized nations, even in European countries, which have the reputation as places where class is determined at birth. But while there is some agreement about the trends overall, there's plenty of disagreement, too, over how serious these findings are, whether the international comparisons are valid, and especially what the solutions might be to address this downward push on upward mobility. Today in The Exchange, is America still the land of opportunity or not? What do you think? Is this country still a place where anyone can get ahead if they work hard? Or is this long-held belief more myth than reality? Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email. The address, exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests. Stuart Butler is director of the Center for Policy Innovation at the Heritage Foundation. He worked on the Pew Center's Economic Mobility Project. And Stuart, good to have you. Welcome back.
My pleasure.
Also with us, Isabel Sawhill, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, co-director of the Center on Children and Families, and co-author of the book Creating an Opportunity Society. And she also worked on that Economic Mobility Project. And Isabel, good to have you too.
Good morning.
Well, and Isabel, to you first, before we get into what has happened and crunching all the numbers, how do you see this idea of economic mobility embedded in our cultural DNA? I mean, we've been taught it for generation after generation after generation.
It's really very striking when you look at surveyed data on people's attitudes in America and compare them to the way people think in other advanced countries. Americans really believe very strongly in individual effort. They believe if you work hard, if you do play by the rules, that you're going to be just fine. And they don't believe that government has a major role to play in that. They really believe in individual responsibility for getting ahead. And they believe if you do the right things, you will get ahead.
Stuart, is this how the rest of the world sees America still? You know, roads paved with gold, go there, work hard, and anyone can make it.
Well, first of all, I do agree with what Isabel just said, and also that Americans tend to be less concerned about differences in income than is true in other countries, and more concerned about whether people can move up the ladder. I think when you look at other countries, I think it's still the case that other countries believe that if they had the choice and they were people who really wanted to try to make it, then coming to the United States is still the best place to come compared with, say, going to Europe. We don't see plane loads of Americans from the Midwest all heading off to Denmark. But we certainly see a lot of Europeans, to say nothing of Asians and people from Latin America, coming to our country.
So, Stuart, and speaking as a European now yourself, does the rest of the world, including Europe, still see America as this shining beacon of entrepreneurial energy where anybody can make it up the ladder?
Yes, I think they still do. Although I think, as the premises of the program suggest, that it's a little bit more of a complicated picture right now, particularly for people who are at the bottom end of the income ladder. I think Bell and I would both agree that we have what we call sometimes a stickiness problem in the United States, that people who are born into very difficult circumstances actually can find it harder to move up than is true, say, in other countries. But I would certainly argue that people who have strong views about how to move up and are in the middle class and upper middle class still have better opportunities here going to be true in other countries.
Well, we'll definitely talk about that stickiness that you mentioned, Stuart, at the bottom. But one more thing, Isabel, before we dive into this. There is the idea that our society has changed, that we used to be the land of opportunity, but now that dream is slipping. Is it correct, Isabel, to say we used to be the nation where anybody willing to work hard could make it, or is that a myth as well?
I think that's still a controversial question. In other words, there have been studies that have shown some decline in mobility and others that have shown no such decline. We don't have very good data going back into history, so it's a hard question to answer. One argument that some people make is that because we have a lot more inequality of incomes now than we did, say, 40 years ago, and that's not controversial, I think everyone accepts that, that the rungs on the ladder are getting much further apart, and that makes it harder to climb the ladder, especially if you're on the bottom rungs.
Well, and speaking of climbing the ladder, so Isabel, what's the best way to measure economic mobility? How do you measure this thing?
Well, there are different time frames over which you can measure mobility. You can talk about intergenerational mobility. In other words, how well are you doing relative to how your parents did? And that's the type of mobility that I think Stuart and I have both tended to focus on. But there's also short-term mobility. How do you do, over the next 5 years or over your own career? And every element of mobility has a story around it. But I think this question of will you do better than your parents is an important one. And there are two reasons why you might do better than your parents. One would be if the economy is growing strongly, and so everybody's incomes are going up. Everybody's on the up escalator. But the other way you could get ahead is if you simply leapfrogged everybody else. And some people are moving up the ladder, some people are moving down over a generation. And we have in the past had some of both. But in recent decades, because economic growth has slowed down, this whole question of your relative position on the ladder has become a more important issue.
Yeah. And Stuart, I'd like to hear from you on that, too. How do you measure this? Is it the intergenerational mobility that Isabel talks about? I'm doing better than my parents. Or is it how I'm doing now versus how I was doing 5 years ago?
Well, you know, economists like Isabel and I always seem to manage to complicate matters. When you start looking at a word that a word like economic mobility that I think most people would assume means, can I move up the economic ladder in some way? If I work, as you said at the beginning of the program, if I work hard and play by the rules, will I move up? But as we've already explained, there are several ways of defining this, you know, relative to what? Relative to other people, relative to where the typical person was several years ago, or maybe relative to your parents. Because one of the problems we have in this kind of discussion is that in many respects, certainly looking at the international evidence that's been discussed in the press recently, it focuses on, is there a strong relationship between how a child does in their later life compared with their parents? And if that's narrow, in other words, if the children don't depart much from their parents, then that's considered very low mobility. And if they move a lot, then it's considered high mobility. The complication with that is that, let's say you're living in a country like the United States, where perhaps the American economy really does reward very strong traits that tend to be passed from parents to children, such as working hard, such as encouraging people to save and value education. If that might then mean that children of people with one level of education will tend to their children will tend to do about the same as they do. In other words, there'll be a close connection. But I think in America we would say, wouldn't we, that if somebody, if a parent who's done well in life, well educated, says to their child, "Do what I did, work hard, and so on, go to college," and that child does as well as they do, we wouldn't really say that is not economic mobility, would we? Although from a technical point of view, you could argue that that means we're less mobile.
Even though the child was doing pretty well by most people's standards.
And not only doing pretty well, but doing pretty well because of some of the advantages in terms of attitude, maybe money too, love of education, thinking about the future, has been passed on from the parents to the children. When you look at very high mobility by this definition, it would basically mean your parents didn't really count for much with regard to how you did. So if your parents tried to encourage you to do well in a high mobile society, they wouldn't have made any difference to you. I mean, that's the sort of irony of these kinds of comparisons.
Let me invite our listeners to join us. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at upward mobility and why some say it's not what it used to be. 1-800-892-6477. Tell us what you think. Is America still the land of opportunity or not? Is this country still a place where anybody can get ahead if they work hard? Or is this belief more a myth than reality? Let's hear from you this hour. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. You know, Isabel, I have to say, as I said in the beginning of the program, it is interesting that there is some agreement, at least, that economic mobility is stickier than we thought. And we'll get into the disagreements over what you do about that. But I find that interesting that Heritage and your group and other groups and Barack Obama and Rick Santorum are all kind of talking about this.
Well, that's right. I think it is a new issue that's been put on the agenda in the past couple of years. And you are hearing presidential candidates and others speaking about it. When the president gave his speech in Kansas, he talked a lot about how much opportunity we have in America. One thing I might point out relating to something you said earlier is that for immigrants, and Stuart mentioned this as well, for immigrants, I think America is still the land of opportunity. So we're not talking about their experience as much as we're talking about if you're born in the U.S., how much does the type of family that you're born into predetermine where you're going to end up? You know, how strong is that link?
All right. We will talk more after a short break and start taking your calls and emails. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And we'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the NEEP Network organizations hosting Destination College, a college planning convention for high school juniors and parents in March. Information at destinationcollege.org. And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, providing online health tools and podcasts for a healthier New Hampshire. Information at dartmouthhitchcock.org. More on a wake-up call for the American dream on The Exchange on NHPR, then a 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, objections to reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny. High temperatures near 20 in the North Country, 25 to 30 in central New Hampshire, and 30 to 35 in southern parts of the state. Tonight clear, not as cold. Lows tonight single digits north of the White Mountains, teens in central parts of the state, and around 20 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at economic mobility in the U.S. and some concern that it's becoming harder to move up the ladder. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. You can go to our page, join the conversation there. Our guests are Isabel Sawhill. She's with the Brookings Institution, and Stuart Butler with the Heritage Foundation. And both of you, let's go to the phones now. Chris is calling from Concord. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi.
Go ahead, Chris. You're on.
My comment is, what does, in terms of economic mobility, people staying in the workplace for many, many more years than, you know, my father's fathers were?
Where you retired at 62 and you're pretty much done, Chris, right?
Right. And I know people that, you know, that are ahead of me that are in their 70s and still working.
Right.
So that's pushing all of those people down. So, you know, I'm in my 30s, but where I would like to be is far below where I can be because there's people that are, you know, ahead of me still.
Right. They're staying in those higher level jobs. It's a question that I had not thought of. What do you think about, Stuart?
Well, I think Chris is right to some degree. Clearly, if you've got a finite number of jobs, then if some people are staying in the workforce for much longer, that is going to reduce the opportunities for newcomers. That was very much when I lived in Britain in the 60s and 70s. That was very much an issue, and there was forced retirements and so on. We don't tend to do that quite so much here. On the other side of the coin, what we're also seeing, of course, is that Americans are healthier, longer. People who are 65 today, and I'm turning 65 this July, don't think of themselves as sort of at the end of their productive life generally. And so they want to continue and so on. And it's one reason why people can acquire a lot more wealth over time. So it's one of these wrinkles in the whole picture that Chris has pointed to that has pluses and minuses for different people within our society.
Right. Well, it's interesting. And Isabel, you know, he's right. He's trying to move up, but he can't move up as long as there are people in their 60s and even 70s staying in those positions.
Well, I think that the assumption there is that we have a finite or fixed number of jobs in the economy. But if you look historically, we have been an enormously flexible labor market in the United States. We have absorbed millions of immigrants. We have absorbed millions of women coming into the labor force over the past half century. And it has not been a problem. So if there's a problem, it's because demand is insufficient to employ everybody that wants to work. And right now, we have a problem because there isn't enough people out there buying goods and services, and therefore employers aren't hiring. And I think that that's a very different reason to be worried about whether you can get a job than the fact that you might be competing with someone who is trying to get into the labor market or wants to stay in the labor market because they're older and they don't have enough money to retire yet.
Well, Chris, thanks for the question. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. We want your thoughts on whether America still is the land of opportunity where anybody can get ahead if they work hard, or if this is more myth than reality. Give us your thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Mark that I'd like to share with both of you. He says, how much of lower upward mobility can be attributed to lower numbers of manufacturing and related jobs in the U.S.? That's his first question. The second one is, when was the last time that upward mobility in the U.S. was considered good? Mark, thank you. Two good questions. Stuart, first of all, to you, what about the number of manufacturing and related jobs? We hear, the narrative that we hear is that those solid middle-class jobs are going by the wayside, being replaced by, you know, Walmart and McDonald's jobs.
Well, I think what's really happening is not so much that. I mean, there is certainly less opportunity in the so-called standard production line jobs at high pay than there was in the past. That international trade has affected that, competition with our automobile manufacturing, for example. But that said, what we really see is a lot of opportunity in this country for knowledge-based jobs, including skills in areas like healthcare and elsewhere. The issue with that is that it does require people not only to have a high school diploma, which a generation or two ago was enough to get you onto track for that blue-collar manufacturing job, but it requires you to have upper-level skills, post-secondary college degrees and so on, and that's where we seem to be having more and more of a problem of people being able to acquire that critical credential in order to be on track for the equivalent in today's economy of that sort of solid, upwardly mobile job that people would look forward to in the manufacturing area. And that's, I think, as Isabel and I would agree on, when we see the problems of our education system in this country, that in many ways is a huge impediment for people acquiring today's equivalent of that job on the production line.
So that's a structural problem that's holding
Absolutely.
People back, you're saying, Stuart.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's where, when we talked about the stickiness, the problems in our education system, I think, are a major factor and a major concern that is getting in the way of people being able to move up, particularly people from less advantaged neighborhoods who, say, have to go to a really terrible local school and then don't get into college, or they get into college and drop out with debt.
It's too expensive,
too. Staggering problem. Absolutely. That's a staggering problem and really sets people back. That's like being pushed down a few rungs. You start to get up, and then you drop out of college or something like that, and you have debt and still no credential, and then it's very hard to get a good job in today's economy.
So let's tackle this stickiness issue, Stuart, that you raised. And Isabel, to you, so who are you especially worried about in terms of ability to move up? Is it just, and I'm not trying to belittle this, but is it just the people at the very bottom, or are you worried about sort of the people at the bottom of the middle class and the middle class? Who are we really worried about when we talk about economic mobility being pushed downward in the United States?
Well, I don't think it's the middle class. People who are born to middle class families, children that are born to middle class parents, they have about an equal chance of either moving up the ladder relative to their parents or moving down. And so you could say that's going to really depend on you know, how good an education they get and a variety of other factors. The people who I think we're most worried about, I'm most worried about, are the people in, let's say, in the bottom, third of the income distribution.
That's children, a lot of people.
Well, it is. And you know, the cutoff point is arbitrary. But the point is that if you're born to parents who are not very well off themselves, who don't have the wherewithal to give you a good education or live in a neighborhood where you can go to very good schools and expose you to all kinds of other advantages, it's going to be a lot harder and a lot harder than it used to be because, as you and Stuart were just discussing, we are now a knowledge-based economy. And it's not sufficient to just have a strong back and a high-paying factory job.
So how do you get around that, Isabel? And Stuart, I want to hear from you, too. But how do you get around those new demands, meaning that it is harder for those in the bottom third to move up? Isabel, you first, and then Stuart.
Well, I think Stuart already put his said the right thing, which is that education is the door to upward mobility. And so you need to have a family that emphasizes education. You need to go to good schools. You need to work hard while you're in school. Without a good education, in today's economy, you're absolutely not going to do very well. You're going to have a hard time finding a job, any job, and whatever job you find is likely to be very low paid.
Well, and here's a question for you, Stuart, on that same line then. On this emphasis that you and Isabel are making on strong public schools, strong K through 12, and more availability of higher education, it seems like these education budgets have been cut a lot in recent years, are only going to get smaller as state and local governments struggle. And then, Stuart, there's some question at the K through 12 level anyway, whether more money always leads to better quality. So can you sort this out for us? I mean, it's fine for you and Isabel to sit there and say, yay, yay, more education, but right. How do you do that?
I think there are a number of factors. And let me just point out that when you look at higher education particularly, we're facing a daunting problem. And it sometimes comes in unexpected ways. One major factor, and this is from a Pew study, as to whether people go to college or not, is whether their families have built up a lot of home equity, because that enables them to borrow, it enables them to feel more secure about the costs of covering their child in higher education. And indeed, the run-up of house values in the 80s and 90s has been attributed to about a 24% increase in the was a 24% increase in the number of people from families of below $70,000 a year going to college. The collapse in house values in the last couple of years, where house values in the same group, $70,000 and below, has dropped over 50%, it's estimated that that will reduce the number of children from those families going to higher education by as much as 30%.
Wow, so just because of home equity.
That one issue has that. Now, then add on what you just referred to, climbing tuition costs, particularly in the state universities, and so on. And we're facing, I believe, a crisis of access in higher education. I think the solution to this is not to think we can somehow keep sort of chasing this runaway bull of costs, but we've got to have radical changes in K-12 and in higher education. It's coming, I think, in higher education already with the growth of online education, a lot of very interesting developments there that could bring the cost down dramatically and therefore open up opportunities. In K-12, I think it's recognizing that you can't just pump money into, say, local public schools in poor neighborhoods that are really terrible schools. We've got to have the kind of disruptive innovation and change through charter schools, which we're doing, through education choice and so on, that's going to break up that obstacle to children moving up the economic ladder.
What do you think, Isabel? And then we'll go back to our callers, so stay on the line if you're there. This idea of both you and Stuart are saying we need good education, that's what it's all about when it comes to moving up the economic ladder. But how do you get that?
Well, first of all, you do need some resources. You need some money. States bear the major burden for financing education these days, not the federal government, although the president is issuing his budget for the next fiscal year today. And the one area in the budget that he increases, well, actually there are two. One is education and the other is transportation infrastructure. Obviously, we live in very tough fiscal times, making it very hard to increase spending on anything, but that's what he's made a priority. Right now, at the state-local level, because those levels of government are so hard-pressed from a fiscal standpoint, they are laying off teachers, and many areas are moving to save money by only having kids go to school 4 days a week, for example. So it's quite a dire situation. What the research on education shows is that the most important thing to helping children learn is having a good teacher in the classroom. And I do think we need to pay teachers more, but I also think we need to link how much they're paid to their performance. And there hasn't been enough effort on that front so far. I think we also need to invest more in early childhood education. All of the research shows very strongly that it's very, very cost effective, especially for more disadvantaged children who don't get great opportunities at home, to have an experience in like a Head Start program or another early childhood education program when they're very young, helps them be ready for school, helps them to do better once they're in elementary school.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And waiting in Rochester is James. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, yes, thank you. I just wanted to comment that I completely agree with the views on education being an absolutely massive lever towards economic mobility. I've seen that in my own life. And I also wanted to comment that I wonder what your guests think about our country in terms of its own growth and history. I believe that our country is sort of reaching the age of pubescence, as it were, as a country, sort of defining itself as it matures. And I think that a natural outcropping of that is some sort of stagnation in mobility and basically a stronger definition of class structure as we lose that booming immigrant base it's just not as large as it was.
So
when
was,
the country
yeah.
first was founded.
So, James, as we move from a young society into a more middle-aged society, you're saying this some of this stickiness in terms of getting up the economic ladder may be inevitable? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think that's part of what we've seen in some of the European countries. As they begin to age and mature, some of that stickiness is a natural extension.
Sure. You know, Stuart, this is real interesting and an area I wanted to get into anyway with you guys. So go ahead. What do you think, Stuart?
Well, despite my accent, I'm actually an American historian by background, so it is something that I think about a lot. I think there are two or three things in response to James's question. One is, of course, it's not just we who are maturing, but other societies too. And when you look at relative differences, there's no question, when I go back to Britain, maybe once a year, I left permanently about 25, 30 years ago, I actually feel more and more foreign each time I go back, and it's not because I'm losing the lingo there, but it's more because those societies really are changing very rapidly, and certainly did in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And so I think one of the things that's going on is we are seeing our position relative to other societies changing, mainly because they're doing better, and they're becoming more open and so on. That is one of the things that's going on. But I think I wouldn't agree that America has kind of reached a level of maturity or pubescence or whatever the right term is, that where we should sort of expect things to be basically slower in the future, less mobile. I don't think that's the case. I think that we actually have very specific problems in the United States and obstacles that are there. And if we were to address those, I think we could really have a resurgence of the kind of upward mobility among people from the lower end of the economic ladder that was really a critical part and a basic part of America for decades.
So obstacles, number one, you would say, Stuart, is education, right, that we just talked about?
I think education, I think, you know, that's we've talked about that. I think we've seen breakdowns in various forms of community in the United States. We have an enormous proportion of people coming from lower-income families that have single parents, for example. It's much harder if you're born with one parent for that parent to give you the kind of opportunities and for you to have them. I think that's a big factor. We've seen that in particularly African-American community in the United States, but also in some of the white communities. And those are the kinds of things we've also got to address.
All right. And more conversation after a short break. Thanks for that call, James. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be back in a minute.
The legacy one leaves for a community can last for generations. I'm Anna Moskoff, Plan Gifts Officer at NHPR, and I'd like to talk to you about the many ways in which you can support NHPR, like leaving a gift through your estate. You can make a lasting impact on this new service for the next generation of public radio listeners in New Hampshire. For more information, please call 800-639-4131 or visit the support page at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Soloway & Hollis, providing effective representation for estate planning, domestic relations, and family-owned businesses throughout New Hampshire. And the Toadstool Bookshops of Keene, Milford, and Peterborough, local New Hampshire booksellers now offering e-books. Store locations and hours online at toadbooks.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, with defense cuts on the table, will the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard be under siege? Email us your questions and comments before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today on The Exchange, we're examining the argument that climbing the economic ladder in America has become harder. Join us with your questions and comments on that at 1-800-892-6477. Is America still the land of opportunity that we've always been told it was? What do you think it takes to move up these days? Is it the family you're born into? Is it the quality of your schools? Is it your own initiative and hard work? Or a combination of all of these. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange at nhpr.org. And Isabel and Stuart, a couple emails coming in that I'd like to share with you. Here's one from Patrick in Dover. He says, I hear more and more people saying that a master's degree or an advanced degree is the new bachelor's degree. In other words, the value of a bachelor's is no longer worth what it used to be, and a higher degree is now needed for a decent job. What do you guests think of this? Patrick, thank you very much. What do you think, Isabel?
I think that's true. The data, to some extent, show that. The big gap now is not just between having a BA and only having, say, a high school education. It's also between having an advanced degree and having just an undergraduate degree. But I wouldn't want to take that argument too far. I mean, it's still the case that if you graduate from college, your ability to earn a good living is going to be hugely enhanced over people with just high school. So I would say no point in discouraging those who are just seeking to get to that first level.
You know, Stuart talked earlier, Isabel, about the international comparisons, and I want to ask you about that, too. And a couple studies finding America actually does rank worse in terms of mobility than its peer countries and other developed nations. Even GASP, Isabel, in Europe, we here in America have often thought, oh, Europe has, you know, an ossified class structure, and if you're born low, you stay low. What do you think about those comparisons to even Europe?
I think it's been very surprising to me to compare the U.S. to European countries like Germany, France, some of the Scandinavian countries. They do look better than we do in terms of their mobility rates. And I think that we have always thought of ourselves as a very flexible, free, entrepreneurial country, and a lot of that is still true. But I think we are having trouble adjusting to this more mature society and some of the challenges we face that were talked about earlier. For example, we are still investing the bulk of our federal resources in programs that provide benefits to the elderly. I'm talking about Social Security and Medicare. And, of course, we want to do that. We want to provide for those in old age. But those programs are growing very rapidly. And what they're doing is they're creating deficits that we all know about. But secondly, they're squeezing out the investments we should be making to keep our economy and our society more vibrant and strong and competitive. We're not investing what we should, in my view, in education and in infrastructure and in job training and in other areas that would make us more productive and more competitive and more mobile.
There's another difference between America and the Europeans that I want to ask both of you about in terms of this moving up. And Stuart, to you first, accumulating savings. It's often said that Europeans and people in Asian countries save a lot more than Americans do. A, is that true, Stuart? And B, if so, how does that affect upward mobility?
Well, certainly, I mean, it's almost a stereotype when we talk about Asian, and particularly Asian Americans, in terms of their tendency to build savings at a much higher rate is absolutely the case here. And I think that the savings rate question is a very important one. What we've seen in the United States has been a slowdown in the savings rate compared with previous generations. We've also seen people, particularly when they're starting out, putting most of their savings into real estate rather than more liquid assets that could be used, say, directly for education or for travel and things like that, that might enhance their skills. So, and that, of course, I mentioned earlier, the collapse in real estate values has therefore disproportionately hurt those groups that tended to put more of their money in housing. That's true of particularly Hispanic Americans, actually, and African Americans. So that's been a significant factor. Let me just, by the way, just mention that in response to a previous question about higher education. I agree, of course, with Isabel. What I think one of the things we're seeing in the United States is people who have bachelor's degrees, not necessarily going on for higher education, but a big phenomenon in the United States is getting various credentials very specific to jobs and so on, which is a very common pattern now in the United States, which I think is a very good one. And I'd say another thing to just bear in mind, we're talking about all the gloom here. There's one very powerful story that we see in America, which is the opportunities being afforded to women. Starting in the 1980s, we had more women than men getting bachelor's degrees, and now we're finding in higher education, you look at medical degrees, MBAs even, the women are taking over. This has been a phenomenal change in the United States, which has opened up huge opportunities to women that around the world generally, you know, there's nothing to compare with it.
That credential process you talked about is interesting to me, Stuart. Last week we spoke with Ross Cattell. He's the new chancellor of New Hampshire's community college system.
And oh, yes.
He said, you know, we've got more people than we almost have room for at some
that's
of our campuses. So,
yeah.
Right. Let's take another call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Mark's calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
Excuse me. It's almost political blasphemy to suggest, but how much of it is due to the government supports that are prevalent at the lower economic levels? I mean, if people are comfortable, part of the premise of the American dream is hard work, but if you're comfortable, it's human nature to relax. So how much of it is that?
No, I'm not sure what you're saying, Mark. Are you talking about government supports for those at the lowest end, or are you saying...
Yeah.
Flesh it out a little bit, because I'm not quite sure I know what you're saying.
Well, at the bottom third of the economic ladder, there are many government supports that provide people enough money for basic creature comforts. And part of the American dream is hard work. So if you're comfortable, you have less of a tendency to work. I mean, it's human nature. It's just that's the way it is. So
I see what you're saying. Okay. Yeah. What do you think, Isabel?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. But I think it can be overemphasized. There was a very interesting article, Mark, that you should look at if you haven't seen it already. It was on, I think, the front page of the New York Times yesterday. I read it online, which is why I don't know where it was. And it was all about the question you're raising. And it pointed out that there are a very large number and a very large proportion of Americans who are receiving some kind of government benefit. Some of them are disabled. Some of them are poor. Some of them are unemployed. Many of them are simply elderly and collecting a Social Security check and getting benefits through Medicare. And it pointed out that, again, the American ethic is very strongly not to want to be dependent on government. So many of the people who were receiving government benefits were also politically aligned with, let's say, the Tea Party and arguing that those benefits be reduced. But when they were asked, well, do you want your own benefits reduced, they were very conflicted about it because to some extent they found the benefits very useful. And on the other hand, they felt somewhat guilty and uncomfortable about the fact that they were receiving them.
No, Isabel.
So it's a very interesting question.
Yeah, and Stuart, I want to hear from you too. Stuart, yeah. I saw the article too, and it's not 100%, you know, in my head, but I think it found, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it found that, contrary to what you might think, the lower end were actually receiving not as much government benefits as they used to, while the middle class was getting a lot of government benefits.
That is absolutely correct.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly right. Isabel and I have been complaining for years about how much government support goes to people who really don't need it all the way up the level. But let me just refer to Mark's point, because I think that's a very important. I think he's right in many important respects, because I think what he's referring to is those programs that tend to say, if you don't work, if you sort of stay unemployed and so on, we'll give you money. But if you start to move up the ladder, we'll take it away. Think about the whole debate over welfare in the 1990s. 80s and 90s. The argument, the concern was that we had a welfare system that said we'll give you plenty of money if you don't get a job, if you don't marry anybody with a job, and so on. And the big reform of 1996 was to move away from that system, at least to some degree, and say, you know, if you've got assistance and you're able-bodied, we'll push you into the workforce or into some form of work experience, even though we'll keep giving you benefits. And it won't be permanent either. that was a major change that turned what was a stickiness problem in the sense of almost holding people back into something that gave them a kind of a bounce upwards. The whole issue of unemployment insurance is similar. When I lived in the UK, you could live your entire life drawing unemployment. They used to call it the dole. And there were people around me who were able-bodied, who never worked because of that. Now, somehow we've got to have the right combination of helping people when they need it, like right now in our economy, and yet not make the receipt of assistance that discourages people from moving up the economic ladder. We've got to somehow get that equation right. There's a big piece today, I think, in the New York Times about the disability program, and that has in the Washington Post, and that has similar concerns that it sometimes really discourages people with disabilities from actually entering the workforce. So we've got a subsidy program like that that helps people, no question about it. But at the same time, as we're trying to get disabled people into the workforce to some degree for their own dignity as much as anything else, we have a disability program that makes it very hard for them to do that. So those are the kinds of stickiness problems that actually we create ourselves sometimes by not having well-designed programs.
So is Mark on target, or would you say he used to be on target, but we've changed things?
No, I think we've changed it significantly in the welfare area. Not completely. There are still a lot of other issues about welfare that need to be corrected, but at least we recognize the problem in welfare and have begun to address it. I think in some of these other trickier areas, like how you design unemployment insurance appropriately, how you design disability insurance, to reach our twin objective of helping people when they really need it, but then, in a sense, giving them a nudge to move back into the workforce to the extent they can, we haven't quite got that right, so it's a factor. But I would say, generally speaking, the education problem really is a far bigger factor than the way in which we provide subsidies to people.
Let's take one more call if we could. This is Susan in Lowell, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange.
Who?
Susan in Lowell.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. What is upward economic mobility in terms of its relationship to consumerism and having all the great stuff, at getting in debt as a result, and which holds you back, perhaps, economically?
Susan, thanks for calling. And actually, on Tuesday, we're going to be looking more at this idea of savings and consumerism. So join us for that too, Susan. But what do you think, Isabel?
Well, I think Stuart has just spoken quite eloquently to this question. He's pointed out that we don't save enough, and we do tend to get into too much debt, consumers do, and that's in part what brought on the crisis in 2007 and 2008. So no question that we need to be saving more. But, you know, if I could go back to the prior discussion on the extent to which our government safety net is discouraging people from working and climbing the ladder, I agreed with quite a bit of what Stuart said about that. But I would point out that in Europe, they have much stronger safety nets than we do in the United States, especially for working-age families and families with children. And they don't have less mobility as a result of that. So I think we have to be a little bit careful about concluding that our problem is too many benefit programs. We actually have a fairly stingy social welfare system by international standards and given our general affluence. But yes, consumerism is a problem, and people are maxing out their credit cards, probably borrowing too much even for education. Student loan debt is now becoming a huge problem in the United States, and people did kind of go overboard on taking out mortgages, risky mortgages on their homes, And that is an issue.
Well, and just to wrap up with you, Stuart, Isabel and I talked about a little bit earlier in the program, and I want to hear from you, too. How do you hear our country's politicians talking about this now? From President Obama to Rick Santorum, it has been a topic of conversation. And I guess, how good a case do you think they are making as they discuss this income mobility or lack thereof?
I think it's good that they are all bringing up this issue. I think it is something we should all be concerned about. I think what you're beginning to see, and it's still hazy, is really different paths to how to deal with this issue. I think the president in general is looking much more at a European sort of solution in the sense of saying, let's build security, let's use government programs for this. And I think others are saying, well, wait a minute, maybe that isn't the way to go. Maybe it's more to remove obstacles, deal directly with problems like our K-12 system, and not sort of try to kind of provide a sort of birth-to-grave system of security to sort of encourage people and enable people to move up in an orderly way. I think that second approach is what I was brought up with, which is one reason I left the United Kingdom, came to the United States.
Well, both of you, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Isabel Sawhill is a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution, co-author of the book Creating an Opportunity Society. Stuart Butler is director of the Center for Policy Innovation at the Heritage Foundation. Both of them worked on the Pew Center's Economic Mobility Project. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Karen Gohl. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Join our page to continue the conversation. Learn more about what we're doing every day. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.